Here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, May 3rd, 2013 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It's the Federal News Countdown every Friday at 3 with the three most important federal news stories of the week. And my experts choosing those stories this week are Molly O'Neill of CGI Federal. It's great to see you. Thanks for being here today.
Good to see you.
And Tim Hext of AgileX in studio with us, too. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Happy to do it. Both of you are veterans of the Countdown, and you've chosen excellent stories for the three most important federal news stories of the week. We start with...
Number three!
And Molly O'Neill, your third most important federal news story is from NextGov. The headline is 67 senators urge Obama to resolve VA claims backlog. And I guess my only surprise on this is that there weren't 100 names on this, because this has been a pretty nagging, difficult problem for a long time.
Yeah, I agree with you. Actually, that was one of the statements I was going to make, to say only 67.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, there's been quite a few stories on this week, and a similar story to this one, which I almost selected. They were very similar in nature around the same issue, is that for the first time looking at sort of the VA claims, we're also seeing government workers being held accountable now. And I believe the news about, you know, bonuses out there, everything. And so typically when you have, you know, huge processing centers to do these things all over, you have contractors and government staff, senior level people, and usually on the contractor side you have SLAs and service level agreements you have to have. And so what this does is says, listen, all parties need to work together, right? So I think that's pretty significant news, to say the government workers need to work together at the highest level of the career service, the contractors need to work together, right? And we need to say all parties need to be accountable for making sure that things work. The second thing about this, you know, there's, in this article, it talks about sort of the increase. You throw more money at something, and yet the problem's getting worse. So you kind of have to go back and really dive into how do you sort of pull back and really figure out how you can, you know, put money towards things that are really going to push things in the right direction. And sometimes it's not just waiting for the IT system, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you got to do some Band-Aids to improve the business process while you're waiting, because it's not just about waiting. It's about getting to it now. You can't put off 2 years what people need today. You know, you read about these years of waiting. I mean, the article's really, really interesting. 800, 1,000 days. So it's significant, again, because it really says this is a really bad problem. We really need the attention. We need to hold all parties accountable, right? And then we need to really move on this, and that's what the senators are saying. Let's move.
Tim, your new colleague, Roger Baker at AgileX, is a name I keep hearing about this among Molly's colleagues, former colleagues in the CIO community, because Roger had what everybody considered to be the gold standard job for CIOs, mm-hmm. and yet still, despite the fact that he had control over resources, he had the ear of the secretary. In fact, the secretary told him on any number of occasions, fix this problem, mm-hmm. and yet they're still struggling with this, and it proves, if nothing else, that it's not just one person or one group of people or one technology problem, that there are very deep-rooted issues at some, and not just VA. I don't mean to pick on VA.
Sure.
It's agencies across government. These are really hard problems to fix.
Yeah, and as I've started to get to know his insights into this a little bit since he joined AgileX, he reminds me that this is a problem that until very recently was 100% paper. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the impact that we're feeling for how the challenges in this system are, until, you know, just the last few years, have they started to really have an earnest effort to modernize. And it even talks about how the system they've put in place to modernize it is rolling out as we speak. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about applying information technology to these problems, but that does not mean it happens overnight.
It's not like you hit them with a computer and all of a sudden they're fixed. It's not a magic wand deal.
It's not. Time will tell whether this solution is the one that solves it, but so far, the early view on how the cycle of a benefit request getting paid out is going down, where they have started to roll it out. So the other thing I noticed in this article, since you mentioned him, was the idea that they're tying this a little bit to a leadership drain there. But in fact, a lot of folks leave at the term, and it feels to me like that's been tied a little bit. He likes to say that the average CIO tenure is 24 months, so he stayed twice that long. And so this idea that people are leaving because of this, I think that's a little I don't know, staged.
He mentioned on this program a week or so before he left that he had promised, and that was the end of February.
Right.
He said he promised President Obama when he took the job that he would stay till January 20th, 2013. So he said, he kind of looked at his watch and he said, so by my count, I'm working overtime.
Exactly.
Molly O'Neill's third most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is 67 senators urge Obama to resolve VA claims backlog. Tim, your third most important story is really fascinating and funny at the same time. It's from TheVerge.com, and the headline is, I'm still here, back online after a year without the Internet. It's funny. It really is funny while giving us a lot to think about, too.
Yeah, well, I was struck by this at the same reaction, that it was just a little bit off the beaten path for some of the normal stories we talk about. But so Paul Miller, who is a technology writer for The Verge, decided 1 year ago to go offline. And he describes himself as a fellow who's been on the Internet since he was 12, and including his whole career. And he checked out entirely. He went from a smartphone to a dumb phone and unplugged his Internet and his Wi-Fi. And the beginning is, as you'd expect, he lost weight. He found love and happiness and got to know his sister and so on. But then he quickly discovered that it wasn't, the things he missed were not the things I expected. I couldn't do without Wikipedia or Google Maps, but he found he couldn't, he lost his social infrastructure, the folks with whom he became accustomed to communicating, and became a little listless. And maybe when you grow up in a world where that is how you define your social infrastructure, that's interesting. Another reason maybe it struck me is, as I deal with my teenagers now engaging in Facebook and understanding what the boundaries are, maybe it was a timing thing. I've been on Facebook since the beginning. I watch my friends. I communicate with people. But on Tuesday, I made my first Facebook post.
Wow.
In 6-7 years. I'm sort of a lurker. I watch it and I use it all the time. But I've never really had something that I wanted to say. Uh-huh. And it was the same time I read this article and I thought, wow, how different he is from me, where I'm present in this social media, but he was defined by it in many ways. And so I thought this article was pretty interesting.
And that's where my interesting part came from, Molly, is that there's insight here into how people now communicate, whether you're a native like this guy or more like Tim and me, where you've kind of learned it as the technology's come along. Understanding that mentality, because we've made a big deal, I think, over the years about digital natives and the differences. But it doesn't, it's like learning a language. It doesn't take you very long if you use it on a daily basis for it to really become embroidered into your fabric. And I'm having a hard time thinking about what I don't think I could do it, quite honestly, because as this guy found and as Tim suggested, this is the network of tools that I use to communicate with people and live my life, essentially.
Or socialize. There are some great quotes in here, and I was out laughing because I hadn't read it either right before the show, and I said, you know, a couple quotes. Well, and it kind of goes towards, you can't change someone's behavior. So you know, he talks about the fact that he loved, you know, getting all the mail, right? Yeah. He loved receiving mail in his mailbox, and what a great treat that is, right? But yet he didn't respond to any letters, right? And so you know, people are going to cut him off. So he wanted to be a consumer of the, you know, going back, but he didn't necessarily know how to participate back. And he was talking about, you know, sort of the friendships, and he said, well, gosh, you know, a Facebook friend is better than a friend, no friends at all. So to me, it means, you know, that's how he gets his friends. And so there's this whole social, it's not just, like you say, it's not just our mobile devices, right? It's the fact that that's how that generation and his generation in his 20s, right? Mm-hmm. Late 20s. That's how they connect for the first time with someone, right? And so they're not used to going to the rec center and playing a game of pickup. And getting to know someone's friend, he might do that, but he would never say, let's have friends. He'd say, you know, are you on Facebook,
yeah,
right? And they'd connect that way. So, I mean, to me, it's not about unplugging, right? Again,
right,
it was about the social behavior.
Mm-hmm. And how you live that life based on the parameters that you set for yourself. That is one difference, I guess, between if we're going to make this an us and them. And my son's 13, Tim, so mm-hmm. we're dealing with the same thing in our home that, yeah. that sounds like you are. They just do it differently, and they do it naturally, where they do it organically, where you know my wife and I and our friends and so on are kind of figuring it out still as we go along. That is what it looks like.
Yeah,
to me.
And I was struck recently. My niece in college said, oh, Uncle Tim, we don't use email except for really formal correspondence with professors. And they realized that they have just a totally different perspective. They've gone one or two generations deeper into this social means of communications, whereas we're still on the periphery.
This is a great story on theverge.com. The headline is, I'm still here, back online after a year without the internet. We put a link to it, like we do with all of our stories, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Second most important federal news story of the week from Tim Hexton, from Molly O'Neill. When we come back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. And the Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Tim Hext of Agilex and Molly O'Neill of CGI Federal. And we're up to
number two.
Molly, your second most important federal news story of the week is Jared's story on federalnewsradio.com. Jared Serbu's story headline, Sequestration Already Biting Navy and Marine Corps Readiness. And some of the numbers that Jared turned up in this are really surprising to the point of, wow, how does that work that way? Two-thirds of the Marines that aren't deployed now aren't ready to be deployed now. And that's it's amazing to me how we've gotten to this situation this fast.
And I think why I picked this story is, yes, it talks about that. But this story, it also talks about this lag situation, which I don't think most people understand. And so while the Defense Department was waiting to spend and spend, you know, waiting for through sequestration and then for, you know, an appropriation, right? I think what most people don't realize is that if for this lag, all of a sudden you get it. It's not like you can just turn that boat and everything's ready. So no. There was if you're not appropriating the money, you just can't turn things on. In a lot of areas, it's not just like, you know, and I don't mean this crass. It's not just like putting more people in a terminal, right, where you can just get them up there. When you're talking about maintenance and support of aircraft and ships, and you've got to order all this stuff. You can't just turn the money on or give them the flexibility in these CRs when the money hasn't been appropriated, and you're missing months and months and months and months of readiness. And so there's this whole, what I'll say, you know. Ripple effect that, again, even if you get the money, there's still this lag in terms of readiness. So there's the sequestration cuts, and even though there's some flexibility in the CR that's been given, some of the damage in terms of readiness is already there, and you can't just, again, turn it right back on. And so I think it's a good education piece for people to understand a little bit about sort of the federal budgeting process and the appropriations as well.
I need to correct an error. The Jared story says two-thirds of the Navy fleet, not the Marine Corps, units are this. We just quote: due to reduced training and maintenance, almost all of our non-deployed ships and aviation squadrons are soon going to be less than fully mission capable and not certified for major combat operations. That's about two-thirds of the fleet, and those are the words of Vice Admiral William Burke, Deputy Chief of Staff, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Warfare Systems. The Marine Corps, though, has a similar situation. You can read all of that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The budget point, though, that Molly makes is kind of one of the grass-growing, sausage-making process stories that to anybody else makes no sense at all, but to our world is dramatically, critically important.
You know what's interesting to me is in the last couple of years, you've seen a little bit of a change, less so with sequestration, I think, and more just with the delay in the budget. for years and years, if you go to some parts of government, they go, well, what are you guys talking about? We've been dealing this for years. Every year our budget is the last thing to happen. We never buy ahead. But the national security community, DOD, intelligence community, Homeland, they always knew every year, well, we're going to get our budget because you can't cut us, right? And so they never got in the habit of understanding that in October and November and December and January, you will not know what you're going to get next year. And so just in the last year or two, they've said, holy mackerel, what? And they get paralyzed by this, and they say, well, we can't assume anything. It's almost like we have to assume next year we're going to have zero, which is not going to happen. But they don't take on that little bit of risk to plan, to prepare, to be ready. And so that ripple effect you talk about, and it's like they're waking up. I just picture folks in other parts of particularly civilian government going, yeah, welcome to the party.
Yeah, exactly.
And we don't know our budget, you know, until March ever.
The situation here, there's the recovery piece, there's the budget piece. The other piece of this that I think kind of makes the third thing that people are not paying a lot of attention to is the manpower piece, because these are folks, in some cases, the Air Force talked about the idea that they're going to have airmen essentially not able to fly. Well, what are they going to do? They signed up to fly. They're not flying. So you have a morale readiness issue there, too, that, again, Tim, other agencies see this, and we see this from the numbers that we get from OPM and the Partnership for Public Service and some of these other organizations that poll these things. But, boy, it doesn't strike me that active duty military is uniform personnel is where we would want to see any kind of morale problems.
Right. And if you think about it, those people who volunteer to be as part of the military and the armed services, right, pride themselves on readiness.
Yep.
And so I think that's an important thing, and sort of the training, as this article talks about too. So it's not just about the ships and the planes and the things that carry us places and move the Army, but it's also the cuts on the training. Again, you can't turn that on a dime either. It's a constant, and you can't get the air flying times, and you can't do all that, huge ripple down effects. But that's why they joined, that readiness.
Yeah. I try as hard as I can to maintain a glass half full attitude about what we're going to see on when it comes to the budget resolutions this year. We have framework in each of the houses. They don't look anything like each other, but at least we have them. The administration's framework is different too, but again, we have it, we're further along this year than we've been in many years. Any optimism from either of you that might lead to anything good by September 30th? I guess that means no.
I'm not that optimistic. I think you're right. I think that I'm sort of a glass half full myself, too, and so I'm hopeful. But I also know 2014 is a big election year, right?
Yep.
And so it sort of brings different willingness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I'm a little more optimistic. It in some ways, it has to happen. And despite the focus on the cuts and the changes, they're relatively small compared to the whole. And you see it a little bit with the FAA thing last week when in a matter of 4 days, we went from, oh my God, all planes are going to be grounded to fixing the budget.
Yeah.
And how much of that is positioning in order to show how much pain we're really feeling. So I don't know. I'm optimistic, but I'm a cynic as well, a little bit, you know.
All right, so we'll
say hopeful.
Yes,
hopeful.
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. So we'll all cross our fingers and read Molly O'Neill's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week at federalnewsradio.com. That's Jared Serbu's story headline: Sequestration Already Biting Navy and Marine Readiness, and that's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Like all of our stories, second most important story of the week is selected by Tim Hext. Is next on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth. Francis Rose will be right back. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week. This week selected by Tim Hext of AgileX and Molly O'Neill of CGI Federal. And Tim, your second most important federal news story of the week, and Molly's number one are on the same track. They have to do with the Boston bombing. Yours is from FCW. The headline is Boston Probes Big Data Use Hints at the Future. And it was interesting to me, right after the bombing happened, it was a Monday, and the people talking in the government space about big data, the chatter started that evening about how big data would eventually become useful, whether it was video, as we found a couple of days later, turned out to be kind of the impetus for catching the suspects that they were looking for, or combing the other pieces of data that law enforcement had access to. This has been really, it seems to me, we'll look back as on this as a textbook case of the difference between how law enforcement was done before big data and how it's been done since. Is that fair to say, do you think?
I think so. I think there are a couple things that are really interesting about this story and the whole domain of stories about this topic. And that is, as you say, the crowdsourcing nature of the big data was really interesting. The idea that, you know, everybody's individual phones and cameras were tapped right away. How rapidly we were able to assemble a picture of what went on. I don't know if you recall that just a couple of days later when they had stitched together all the videos to say, well, here they are walking down the street. That's them. See, he turns here. Like, how rapidly that all came together was compelling. But to me, it points at really maybe one of the most important lessons, which is, we're very good. We're really very good after the fact. The FBI is a forensic organization. They were designed to find out who did it, not who might do something. And the secret is getting good before the fact, not after. And so the real promise of what we might discover in big data are pointers to what might happen, not quickly determining what did. And so, you know, if you think of the many examples in the past, another example I always like to think of is the DC snipers, you know, when they went from, holy mackerel, I have no idea who this is, to all of a sudden having the stump the guys practiced with, flying, you know, to do ballistics testing. That once it happens, they are good. The challenge is that sort of predictive way of looking forward into those patterns. And this is going to be an opportunity to learn from that. When Umar Farouk tried to light his underwear on fire, the underwear bomb, we learned so much. Luckily, that one failed. But we learned so much about what we ought to have known and what we might have looked for that I think the opportunity, you hate to think of an incident like this as an opportunity, but in the context of big data, the opportunity is to learn from the before, the during, and the after to understand how to predict rather than just react. And we're good at reacting.
There's two pieces of this, Molly, that I think are particularly noteworthy. One of them is how do we look at big data in this context and understand what we really need to do next? Because it seems like we're good at collecting it. And it seems like, as Tim said, we're good at using it afterwards to figure it out. But applying that predictive model to it, I wonder if we have the ability to do that kind of analytics yet, or if that's the next piece. Is it that we don't know how to do that yet, or that we maybe until now didn't even know we could or were able to? Kind of where I'm...
I've thought a lot about this, too. And it's interesting because Tim kind of... took the same approach that I did. The reason I picked the article that I picked was because it says kind of the similar. Let's investigate why we didn't about the information sharing, but also sort of it goes more on the predictive side too, because we're doing a great job now, right? But I think part of it, going back to your question, Francis, is that I think in government as a whole, we do so, and it's not just in the intelligence agency. So like when there's a mishap in an airport, you know, we figure out what let's look at what happened, and then maybe we'll redo something so we time the planes a little bit differently and move the runway patterns differently, right? And that's all part of that. But I think part of it is just the evolution of analytics, tell you the truth, from analytics, or as Tim said, analytics around why things happen, to now focusing and saying, let's not, we need to do that so we can continue to improve, right, so we can stop things from happening again. But what about what we don't, how do you avoid it, which is really the predictive side? And I think that we need to focus on those areas in terms of how you think, kind of questions you ask, and everything else, all the way from, you know, what we're studying in universities all the way up and what we're recruiting into the government. Because to me, it's an evolution of analytics, being able to do that part.
The other element of this that is, I think, worth pursuing is not necessarily a government problem, or there's not necessarily a government solution, but a friend of mine in federal law enforcement after this happened said, after the video deal came out, and that sequence of videos, as you mentioned, Tim, is just fascinating to literally watch them, courtesy of people's phones and surveillance cameras and all of this, watch them go about their business that day. But this friend of mine said this is potentially very, very good for future deterrence and potentially very, very bad for future deterrence, because people who think about doing these kinds of crimes casually will say, well, I'll maybe won't do them because I'm much more likely to get caught. That leaves us with a group of people who don't care if they get caught, mm-hmm. who are willing to do things and suffer the consequences because they're so committed to whatever it is that makes them do the bad things that they're going to do. And that part of it, I don't know how you predict that, and I don't know how you get out in front of that when you have people who are willing to bury their intentions, if they can, for a long time.
Well, I don't know if Kennedy said, if somebody who's willing to exchange his life for mine is going to be really hard to stop. And I think there's some truth to that, and we have not had to deal with us quite as much with that. So that is very hard to stop. The real question is, to what extent do this – regardless of their intentions and regardless of their motivation and how committed they are, how much communication and thinking do they do publicly, or at least in channels that we can pay attention to give us insights? Because in some ways it's more scary that it is just an individual, all of the plans of which are only inside his head. Mm-hmm. You're right. That will always be hard to predict.
Yeah, the lone wolf element of this is particularly scary. Tim Heck's second most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is Boston Probes Big Data Use Hints at the Future, and that's linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Molly O'Neill's number one story of the week is also revolving around the situation in Boston and how that has worked in government circles. We'll talk about that when we come back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. And my guests this week, Molly O'Neill of CGI Federal and Tim Hex of Agilex, and we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Molly O'Neill, as I mentioned, continues in the Boston theme. It's from the Washington Post. The headline is Officials to Review Handling of Boston Bombing Intelligence. And I guess the good news is that we can look at the situation kind of as an information sharing success, because we saw information go horizontally and vertically among government organizations, not just the federal government, but state and local. But on the other hand, it does demonstrate, Molly, I think, that there's still some work to do.
That's exactly why I picked the article. So I always have an interest in this subject, so I see it come up, and so I want to talk about it a little bit. But you're right. I think from where we were in September 2001, I mean, there's been market improvement. And think about all the things that have been thwarted that we don't even read about in the newspaper, right? And so there's been significant, I think, improvements in this area, but there's still holes. And I think that's your point, to say, listen, you know, we had what did everyone know? We know that someone, you know, one of the guys was questioned, right? And so, you know, what different parts of the agencies are not getting together on that? And then, to me, especially in today's in the case that we're looking at now, which may have been because we don't know yet, sort of lone family wolf, right? Little pack.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, with everything that we are monitoring and sharing, how do you find those out? And how are we really pushing this information with the locals as well? And that's something we haven't read about yet in terms, and maybe we won't, maybe there's a reason for it, right? To talk about, it's not just what the federal folks know. Maybe they made a decision that said, you know, this guy, everything that we found does not warrant something, right? Or these brothers. But was the local Boston police notified, so they keep an eye and look for patterns and to continue, as we've talked about in the last section, you know, are there other pieces of data that might change their impression that we don't have to wait for another incident, another call from another country, but we're actually doing something at home a little bit closer when the tags go up.
One of the things that it struck me about that, and I think Molly's points are exactly right, Tim, but one of the things that struck me is we're now finding ourselves in a big data environment where there's so much that there's got to be at some point some kind of a balance between providing everything, because I'm sure that this guy or these two guys or this family weren't the only ones, say, in Boston that somebody at the federal level had information about. So how do you dump all of that onto the Boston police force, for example, or the Massachusetts Commonwealth Police or whoever, whatever organization, and expect them to be able to sort through it all? They have the same kind of budget problems, or maybe worse, at state and local level that the federal government has. And so the analytics piece of this becomes even more critical at a time where we're all still trying to figure out how that part of it works.
Yeah, for me, analytics is all about setting priorities. It doesn't find the answer. There is no way the day before to say that guy's going to do something bad. I mean, maybe. But really what it is, look, we have resources at our disposal to inspect these things or investigate those things. How can the analytics point us at the highest priority, most likely things so that we spend those resources wisely? And I hope that if we sorted it all perfectly and the top 10% of the likely things to investigate and we have 10% resources, we can cover it. But it's likely that we're always going to have more things that we wish we could have investigated. But if we prioritize things based on the strength of how much they're related to what's important to us from a national security perspective, we're more likely to have our investigative resources overlap with the likely events or perpetrators or issues. And that's, I think, the best we can strategize for. Thinking on Monday morning that, you know, we shoulda, coulda, woulda. In this case, we did. We talked to the person. This was not how come we didn't know about him? We did. But there were hundreds or thousands of other people we talked to who did not blow anything up that day. So you got to just prioritize.
The prioritization part of this, Molly, is obviously the very difficult thing. I'm pleasantly surprised by the measured reaction to the government response, and again, not just at the federal level, but I'm pleasantly surprised that we haven't seen any members of Congress or anybody else just screaming and shaking their fists about, well, we're going to get to the bottom of this. It seems to have been a very measured, reasonable response, and this story points to that. Four inspectors general announcing that they're going to look into this. They're going to work together. An oversight government reform committee, the House Homeland Security Committee hearing about this next Thursday. Perfectly legitimate. You would expect each of those people to do those things. Very reasonable, but nothing, no vitriol about this, which I think is a good sign.
And that's a great point. And I think, you know, as we started this segment, there was a lot. I mean, I don't know about you, but I watched everything. You know, that Thursday when they put the pictures up unfold all through the night, because I'm a bit of a news hound, right? And I mean, how proud, you know, are we to say that the community, the different parts of the intelligence community and justice all getting together and doing all the right things, even timing when those pictures, when everyone was grabbing for them, and maybe we weren't ready to release them until then. I mean, I think everyone, there's a lot to say this really worked well under these unfortunate situation. And so I think I think really it's about lessons learned. So how do we take the improvements that we've made and as we've talked about, talk a little bit more about predictive analytics, how can we improve those, help prioritize that so that we continue to get, you know, maybe we're not we're not at 100% protection now, but we're continuing to, you know, inch up and improve and improve. And I think a kind of response like this is something that I think is encouraging to most Americans out there, too, to say, let's not make this political. Let's just make this about what it is and let's look for improvements here.
Tim, we only have about 30 seconds left, but are you confident that if we have this same kind of issue 2 years or 3 years from now, that we'll continue to see this curve headed in the right direction the way that it appears to be right now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think we have already been seeing it. To Molly's point earlier, there are lots of things that haven't happened because these folks are doing good work ahead of time.
The Washington Post is headline is Officials to Review Handling of Boston Bombing Intelligence. It's Molly O'Neill's choice for the most important federal news story of the week. Tim Heck's choice is next to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Molly O'Neill of CGI and Tim Hext of AgileX. And Tim, your most important federal news story of the week is from Fierce Government IT. The headline is Auditors Fault Waterfall Development in Gozar Ground System Development Delays. And this is a story about Commerce Department Inspector General report on the NASA and NOAA project. And I'm sure it's entirely coincidental that somebody that works for a company called AgileX would choose a story about a waterfall program that didn't work as the most important story of the week. That's completely...
I'm afraid, Mr. Rose, I don't know what you're talking about.
They're not connected at all, I'm sure.
I'm sorry I'm so transparent, but I couldn't help myself, because we spend so much time preaching that the way systems get built with these traditional systems development lifecycle methodologies are not effective, and they end up costing a lot of money. But actually, the thing that struck me about this story was not just that obvious headline. When we talk about agile processes for building software, we talk about where waterfall has its place, which is mostly in physical engineering projects, bridges and dams. That's what waterfall was invented to do. And what struck me is a satellite is much more about physics and physical engineering than it is about software development. And maybe it falls somewhere in the middle. My guess is so much of what it takes to get this thing into orbit involves software development. But you can't, unlike rolling out a new payroll system, we can't put it out a little bit and then put it out a little bit more and put it out a little bit more like we do with Agile. This thing got to fly the first time, or it ain't, you know, mm-hmm. or the money goes in the ocean, you know. And so this kind of project is the one that we often hold up as why sometimes maybe waterfall should work. And so it struck me as maybe there's an opportunity to blend the two. It also points a lot at the contract. If you read the last phrase, references the OIG report on it, and so if you click through and read that, it's a lot about the contracting process and award fees given when they weren't deserved, and like there's all sorts of other sort of stuff and finger pointing going on. Yeah, but it's more than just the methodology. But I was struck by the fact that maybe there's some middle ground now, even when we're bending steel and doing physics in order to engineer something physical, there's so much around the processes associated. And if I were going to leave one word on the table, it's probably transparency. Mm-hmm. You know, these projects need to have incremental and transparent progress so that you don't get $10 billion into it before you find out that it ain't going to meet your deadlines. And so maybe that's my way of spinning your directed accusation.
No, and it's not a directed accusation. It's just just something I noticed.
I'm teasing. First.
You are free to choose the stories that you think are important. Yes. I just happened to notice what I wondered was a coincidence. That's all, Tim. There's one sentence in this story, Molly, that I would not have expected to see in a story about a problem with project development. But I guess when I think about it, it's not that surprising. Things got off to a rocky start when a protest against award of the satellite contract caused an 8-month delay, causing data dependency problems in the ground system development almost immediately. And I wonder if we went back and looked at protest delays on some of these big systems, how often we would find that as a common thread.
Yeah, I don't think anyone of us would be surprised to say there's always when these things are delayed so much, there's usually problems. And it's because, you know, we've got people who had staff ready are now 8 months. And, I mean, these are private businesses that, you know, they're if the staff aren't available and the contract that they've planned even within a month or two, they got to really think about these, even if for these big ones. And so I think that if you go back, you will find this is a common problem in most contract protests.
I teased you mercilessly, and I appreciate your good sport, Tim. And this is a great selection. Tim Heck's most important federal news story of the week is headlined Auditor's Fault Waterfall Development in GOES Are Ground System Development Delays. You can find it from Fierce Government IT, linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Tim from AgileX, it's great to see you as always. Molly from CGI Federal, thanks very much for being here, both of you. Terrific federal news countdown that's archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose right around the corner on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.